Welcome, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to today's episode of The Law of Self-Defense. I am, of course, attorney Andrew Branca for The Law of Self-Defense. Come on in. Make yourselves comfortable, everybody. So we are here today to finish up our show from yesterday. We've been covering the decision released from the Ohio Supreme Court just last week, Ohio v. Wilson, which ruled that warning shots can be lawful self-defense and self-defense can be raised as a legal defense to the firing of warning shots. Now, we read the majority opinion yesterday, which was 3 of 7 Ohio Supreme Court justices agreeing on the reasoning to get to that conclusion. A fourth justice agreed with the conclusion, but not with the reasoning, which raises questions about the precedential value of this opinion. And then 3 of the justices dissented from the majority opinion. They feel warning shots cannot be justified as self-defense. Today, we'll be reading the dissent to finish up that case. I suppose I should do a quick review of the facts. I'll do that in just a moment. Essentially, it was a confrontation, a verbal confrontation at a gas station that escalated to a physical threat level. The defendant claims that the other fellow pointed a gun at him, so the defendant retrieved his own gun from inside his car. Both men were in their own vehicles, and the defendant fired a warning shot, said, "I wasn't trying to shoot him. I wasn't trying to hit him or hurt him. I was trying to get him to back off." Fired a warning shot and got charged with attempted murder and a form of aggravated assault, and was found not guilty of the attempted murder, but guilty of the aggravated assault. And during his trial, he was denied a self-defense jury instruction by the trial judge, who simply said warning shots as a matter of law are not lawful self-defense. This can't have been self-defense. For it to be self-defense, you would have to have testified that you intended to hit the other fellow. And the defendant's lawyer didn't object or argue for a self-defense jury instruction. So after he was convicted on the felonious assault charge for the warning shot, he appealed his conviction. The mid-level appellate court agreed with the trial court, affirmed his conviction, said warning shots cannot be self-defense, so no self-defense instruction was warranted. And then he appealed up to the Ohio Supreme Court, and the Ohio Supreme Court said, "Nope. We disagree with the trial court," or at least a majority of the Ohio Supreme Court said, "We disagree with the trial court and the mid-level court of appeals. We believe that a warning shot can be self-defense." We're not saying it was in this case. We're not saying these warning shots were necessarily justified, but warning shots can, in theory, depending on the facts, be lawful self-defense, and therefore the self-defense jury instruction should have been given so the jury could decide for themselves whether or not this warning shot was lawful self-defense. And by not objecting and not demanding for the self-defense jury instruction, defense counsel at trial was constitutionally ineffective. So they reversed the defendant's conviction on the felonious assault charge and remanded back to the trial court. So we'll have to see if the prosecutors want to pursue this defendant again. It's entirely within their discretion to do that. So that's where we are. Yesterday, we read the majority opinions. I'm not going to go over all those again. You can see them in yesterday's show. I'll put a link to that in the description of today's show. Today, we are going to read the dissent. So with that out of the way, let's go ahead and launch the formal start of today's show. And here we go. And I'm suddenly back, and I realize I forgot to open up something important that I needed to share with all of you. So let me do that right now. And it is here. So today's show is sponsored by none other than Law of Self-Defense ourselves. Twice a year, I teach a full-day Law of Self-Defense advanced class, teach you everything you need to know to be hard to convict if you're ever compelled to defend yourself, your family, your property from criminal predation. The next class is coming up. It's Saturday, April 20th. And if you miss this one, it's going to be at least October before this class is available again. We teach you how the criminal justice system deals with cases of self-defense, what makes a case of claimed self-defense attractive as a target for prosecution. In other words, what not to do so you're not making yourself an attractive target for prosecution. We teach you about defense of yourself, defense of others, your family, strangers. We teach about defense of property and the different kinds of property. We spend almost an hour talking about how to interact with the police in the aftermath of a use of force event and much, much more. Over 100 distinct self-defense use of force law questions answered over the course of this day. Plenty of opportunity for Q&A with me. It is a live program streamed to you at your computer. And we're still in the early registration period, so you sign up now and you can save up to 50% off the normal registration. All of that at lawofselfdefense.com/advanced to learn more and register for the class. And I should mention, if you have some kind of conflict on Saturday, April 20th, I would register anyway, because every registered student also gets access to the recorded playback version of this class. So you can watch it over the next couple of weeks at your leisure, if you wish, but only if you're a registered student. Again, it'll be 6 months before we do another one after this class. Can you afford to wait 6 months? Do you know when you're going to be attacked? That's not up to you. That's up to the bad guy to decide the time, place, and manner of attack. You need this information now before that happens. It doesn't help to learn it afterwards. Then it's too late. So I look forward to seeing a bunch of you there Saturday, April 20th, our Law of Self-Defense Advanced class. Sign up now, 50% off at lawofselfdefense.com/advanced. Also, as an aside, to those of you who are watching this on YouTube, at present, I am nine subscribers on YouTube away from 61,000. So there's a bunch of you watching. Let's see how many. Well, it's got to be more than that. Let me refresh that page. There's a bunch of you watching. It would be great if nine of you who are not yet subscribers became subscribers on YouTube. That would be awesome. And of course, everybody should hit that thumbs like up button for sure. For sure. Okay. Now let's get to State v. Wilson. I'll embed the link to this in the description of today's show so you can read the whole court opinion yourself. Let me bump this up a little bit in size. There we go. And of course, the first part of this is the majority opinion that I've already kind of, I did a quick review of the facts for everybody. And this was handed down on March 7th. So just last week, 5 days ago. So brand new law. I'm going to scoop past the majority opinion we covered yesterday and get to the dissent. Before I dive into the dissent, I'll just kind of summarize a key argument in the... There's the conclusion. Maybe I'll just read the conclusion. Before I do that, though, there was really two views of the legal arguments here. One is that the felonious assault charge by the defendant, when the defendant was defending against that charge, there's really two ways to do it. One is an element negating defense. That's where every criminal charge has distinct elements. The state has to prove each and every one of those elements beyond a reasonable doubt. If they fail to do that for any one element of the crime charged, the jury is instructed that they have to acquit you. And a negative element negating defense might be something like, well, the state has to prove it was me who did whatever the bad thing is, and it wasn't me. I have an alibi. I was someplace else. I wasn't at this scene when the bad thing happened. So you're negating one of the elements of the criminal charge. The other type of defense that you can raise, class of defense, is not an element negating defense, but a affirmative defense. And an affirmative defense is one in which you're conceding to the underlying conduct. You're not saying it wasn't you who did whatever the bad thing is. You're saying the opposite of that. You're saying it was me. So I concede all the elements of the criminal charge, but I nevertheless should not be held legally liable because I have an affirmative defense, in this context, the legal defense of self-defense. So when you claim self-defense, you're not saying you didn't shoot that guy. That's what an alibi defense would be doing, an element negating defense. When you're claiming self-defense, you're saying the opposite of that. You're saying, I did shoot him. He died as a result of my bullet. I did that. But I did it under the circumstances that my conduct qualifies as lawful self-defense and therefore was legally justified, and I should be free of criminal liability. In this case, the state prosecutors and the dissent here was essentially arguing that because the defendant here stated repeatedly that he never intended to actually hit the aggressor with the bullet, but merely to fire a warning shot to scare him, to get him to back off, that what he was doing was raising an element negating offense, because one of the elements of assault would be that you intentionally sought to cause somebody harm. And the state says, well, if that's what he was doing, if he was raising an element negating defense like we are arguing, then that's not self-defense. Self-defense is when you concede to the underlying elements of the criminal charge. And if it wasn't self-defense, he should not be entitled to a self-defense jury instruction. That's the argument that convinced the trial judge to deny the self-defense jury instruction and convinced the mid-level appellate courts to agree with the trial court that that was the right decision. That's what the majority of the Ohio Supreme Court disagreed with. They said the defendant was not engaged in an element negating defense, but in an actual affirmative defense, conceding the underlying conduct. He never denied he fired the shot. He said he fired a warning shot as self-defense. So if you want all the details on that, you should watch yesterday's show. But I'll just read the conclusion from the majority opinion, and then we'll dive into the dissent just to provide context. So the majority conclusion: the requisite state of mind or intent that the defendant must have had to be entitled to a self-defense jury instruction is an intent to use force to repel or escape force. The trial court and second district, that would be the mid-level appellate court, erred in holding that Wilson, the defendant, needed to show a different state of mind or intent, that is, an intent to harm or kill another person. Under the evidence presented in this case, Wilson was entitled to a self-defense jury instruction. Thus, his counsel was prejudicially ineffective by failing to request that instruction. We therefore reverse the judgment of the appellate court below them, vacate Wilson's conviction, and remand this matter to the trial court for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. Reversed and cause remanded. And two other justices concurred with this analysis, the reasoning, how they got to this conclusion. These were all apparently liberal justices on the Ohio Supreme Court. And then a fourth justice, purportedly a conservative justice on the Ohio Supreme Court, concurred in judgment only. So he agrees with the outcome, the decision to reverse and remand, but he doesn't say he concurs with the analysis. So the analysis doesn't actually have a majority of the Ohio Supreme Court, which undermines its precedential value. Now the dissent. So three of the justices, all characterized as conservatives on the Ohio Supreme Court, dissented with that majority opinion, written by Justice Dieters. And he writes, because Tyler Wilson's claim that he did not intend to hurt Billy Reffert was not an affirmative defense to the charge of felonious assault, he was not entitled to a self-defense jury instruction. The lead opinion sees it otherwise and compounds its error by deciding an ineffective counsel claim that was not raised before this court. So I respectfully dissent. First subsection of the dissent: the evidence presented at trial did not constitute an affirmative defense. So that was just a summary statement of the defense findings. Now they're going to explain how they believe the court should have arrived at that same conclusion. Wilson asserts a single proposition of law in which he argues that he was entitled to a self-defense jury instruction. Quote, a court's instructions to the jury should be addressed to the actual issues in the case and as posited by the evidence and the pleadings. That's citing another decision. Close quote. The first question then is whether there was sufficient evidence presented to warrant a self-defense jury instruction. The answer requires a review of self-defense as an affirmative defense. Ohio has long recognized self-defense as an affirmative defense. By the way, I did a lengthy exposition yesterday on why I really dislike the use of the phrase affirmative defense, and primarily it's because although the phrase used to have a consistent universal meaning across the United States, that ended decades ago. So the way Ohio defines affirmative defense is different than how other states now define it. That doesn't matter if you're only using the phrase within one state, because then everyone involved is using the same definition. But when you're talking about use of force law and justification defenses across 50 states, and you're using the phrase affirmative defense, everyone thinks that you're talking about whatever it is they think affirmative defense is in their jurisdiction. But in fact, everyone listening across the United States is thinking of something else when the phrase affirmative defense comes in. So it only creates confusion. Nevertheless, here, of course, the Ohio Supreme Court speaking only to Ohio law. So it's fine in this context. The recent change to Ohio self-defense statute regarding the burden of production and proof for self-defense has not changed self-defense's categorization as an affirmative defense. So I mentioned this yesterday, but in every state of the United States, once the burden of production on self-defense has been met, once the defendant has shown some more than zero evidence to support each of the required elements of self-defense, he's earned the right to argue self-defense to the jury and get a self-defense jury instruction. Once he's done that, met his burden of production, and gotten self-defense as a legal defense into court, then the burden shifts to the state. The burden of proof, the burden of persuasion shifts to the state, and the state has the obligation to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. Many decades ago, it was common that that burden of persuasion was still on the defendant. He had the burden of production, the defendant did, and the burden of persuasion to prove self-defense by a preponderance of the evidence. And until 5 years ago, Ohio was the last state to still do that, to put the burden of persuasion on the defendant by a preponderance of the evidence. But 5 years ago, that changed. 5 years ago, Ohio joined the other 49 states to shift the burden of persuasion onto the state to disprove it, disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what the court here is referring to when it says the recent change to Ohio self-defense statute regarding the burdens of production and proof, they mean persuasion, for self-defense has not changed self-defense's categorization as an affirmative defense. This court has explained affirmative defenses such as self-defense this way, quote, affirmative defenses represent not a mere denial or contradiction of evidence which the prosecution has offered as proof of an essential element of the crime charged, but rather they represent a substantive or independent matter, which the defendant claims exempts him from liability, even if it is conceded that the facts claimed by the prosecution are true. On this much, the lead opinion agrees, writing that, quote, self-defense must be a true defense, a justification for the conduct, not a negation of the elements of the underlying charge. Close quote. But the lead opinion goes on to determine that Wilson's version of events constituted the assertion of a true defense and not a negation of the elements of felonious assault. In doing so, the lead opinion focuses on the mens rea, the mental state required for felonious assault. Distilled, the lead opinion's reasoning goes something like this. Felonious assault requires a person to act knowingly, intentionally, shooting a gun. Felonious assault requires a person to act knowingly. Intentionally shooting a gun satisfies the knowingly element. Wilson, therefore, did not negate an element of felonious assault when he admitted that he had intentionally fired the gun. The problem with the lead opinion's reasoning is that its focus is too narrow. Wilson was charged with felonious assault under Revised Code 2903.11A2, which makes it a crime for a person to knowingly cause or attempt to cause physical harm to another by means of a deadly weapon. There was no evidence that Wilson caused physical harm to Ruffett, so the state of Ohio had to prove that Wilson attempted to cause physical harm to Ruffett, a premise Wilson flatly denied. Remember, he says he wasn't trying to hurt Ruffett, he was just trying to scare him back with the warning shot. Continuing now with the opinion. At trial, Wilson conceded that he had intentionally fired the gun that was in the car he was driving, but he was adamant that he had not intended to hurt Ruffett. Question, did you intend to strike Ruffett? Answer, no, I intended to scare him and back him off. Wilson repeated this assertion multiple times during his testimony. He also questioned whether the shot he fired had caused the damage to Ruffett's truck. There was a dent. Quote, I don't think that bullet hole was even from me. That wasn't even a bullet hole, that dent. That close, I just aimed out the window and fired up. Close quote. Based on his version of the shooting, Wilson did not, quote, concede that the facts claimed by the prosecution were true, close quote. Instead, Wilson sought to negate the attempt to cause physical harm element of felonious assault. If the jury had believed Wilson, it would not have found him guilty of felonious assault. His defense that he had fired only a warning shot was not an affirmative defense. The lead opinion seems to accept Wilson's argument that the Court of Appeals decision imposed a heightened burden of production on him in concluding that in order to assert self-defense, he had to concede that he intended to kill or harm Reffitt. But because Wilson did not present evidence of a true affirmative defense, the allocation of burden in Ohio self-defense statute did not apply. The ultimate burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt all the elements of felonious assault, including causing or attempting to cause physical harm, remained with the state. And nothing prevented Wilson from arguing that the evidence on that element had not been proved. The Court of Appeals decision, this would be the mid-level Court of Appeals that affirmed the conviction. The Court of Appeals decision cited by the lead opinion. Oh, no, these are different Court of Appeals decisions. Sorry. The various Court of Appeals decisions cited by the lead opinion here do not persuade otherwise. Notably, those cases are not about whether a self-defense jury instruction was warranted or whether the defendant had caused or attempted to cause physical harm. Instead, those cases address the sufficiency or manifest weight of the evidence regarding the mens rea or mental state element of felonious assault. And though the lead opinion characterizes this dissent, what we're reading right now, this dissent, as arguing about what evidence would be sufficient to establish an attempt to cause physical harm, that's not the point. My concern is not the absence of direct evidence, quite the opposite. The problem is that there is evidence in the record of an active denial by Wilson that he attempted to cause physical harm. Because Wilson attempted to negate an element of felonious assault at trial, he did not assert a true affirmative defense. He did not concede the elements of the underlying criminal charge. He was therefore not entitled to a self-defense jury instruction. We should affirm the Court of Appeals judgment for this reason. Second subcategory of the dissent, counsel was not ineffective. So the majority opinion here had concluded not only that the trial court should have given a self-defense instruction, but also that defense counsel was ineffective for requesting the self-defense instruction in the first place, or at least for fighting for it, objecting to the denial. Those two really go hand in hand. If you believe that the self-defense jury instruction was warranted, then it has to be ineffective assistance not to fight for it and not to object to the instruction being denied. But if you don't believe the self-defense jury instruction was warranted, well, then counsel was not ineffective, which is what the dissent will argue here. The sole proposition of law presented by Wilson and accepted for review by this court was as follows, quote, is the accused entitled to a self-defense instruction for firing a warning shot at an armed aggressor, or must they shoot to injure or kill in order to receive the instruction at trial, close quote. The discussion above disposes of the proposition. Wilson was not entitled to a self-defense jury instruction. That should be the end of this court's consideration of Wilson's appeal. But the lead opinion's discussion ranges beyond Wilson's proposition of law. The lead opinion concludes that Wilson's proposition of law represents only a slight difference in the wording from the assignment of error that he raised in the Court of Appeals, which stated, quote, trial court provided ineffective assistance of counsel by failing to ask that the jury be instructed on self-defense and erroneously conceding that self-defense does not apply to the facts and circumstances of Mr. Wilson's case, close quote. And so the lead opinion goes on to consider whether Wilson's trial counsel was ineffective. But Wilson did not present a proposition of law about ineffective assistance of counsel in his memorandum in support of jurisdiction to this Ohio Supreme Court. The lead opinion declares that this court understood Wilson's argument to include his ineffective assistance of counsel claim when we accepted his appeal. The source of this understanding is unclear, When we accept a jurisdictional appeal, we do so on the proposition of law presented by the appellant. No amount of squinting or reading between the lines will reveal any claim regarding ineffective assistance of counsel in the accepted proposition that Wilson presented. Our review should be limited to addressing the single proposition of law set forth by Wilson and accepted for review by a majority of this court. Nevertheless, because the lead opinion has addressed the issue, I will briefly discuss why its conclusion regarding the ineffective counsel claim is incorrect. Counsel's performance will not be deemed ineffective unless and until counsel's performance is proved to have fallen below an objective standard of reasonable representation, and in addition, prejudice arises from counsel's performance. In other words, that it made a difference. Counsel was not only bad, but them being bad, would have led to a different verdict if they had not been bad. And they cite here to Strickland v. Washington, which is the U.S. Supreme Court seminal case defining the scope of ineffective assistance of counsel. Judicial scrutiny of counsel's performance is to be highly deferential, and reviewing courts must refrain from second-guessing the strategic decisions of trial counsel. To justify a finding of ineffective assistance of counsel, the appellant must overcome a strong presumption that under the circumstances, the challenged action might be considered sound trial strategy. The lead opinion briefly nods at the notion that we typically defer to trial counsel's decisions as a matter of strategy before it concludes that there was little doubt that counsel's decision not to request self-defense jury instruction could not be chalked up to trial strategy. A closer look at what happened at trial, however, reveals that defense counsel's strategy was not unreasonable. The lead opinion states that, quote, while Wilson initially presented a theory of self-defense, his counsel abandoned that theory at the suggestion of the court, close quote. This assertion glosses over the discussion that took place before the closing arguments. The court, quoting now from a transcript, the court. At first, I thought we were looking at a self-defense case, but the more I heard the defendant testify, I believe that the defense in this case is that the defendant did not aim the gun at the victim, did not intend to hurt the victim or kill the victim. His testimony was that he fired the gun in the air to scare them off. So to me, that's the defense. Now, that being said, because of that, I don't think a self-defense instruction is warranted. But I certainly think the defense has every right to argue that the reason he fired the shot in the air was because he was afraid, perhaps for his life. I don't have a problem with that argument, but I don't see it as a true self-defense case because he's saying he didn't fire the shot at the victim. Is that how you see it, defense counsel or prosecutor? Defense counsel, yes. Prosecutor, I agree, yes. Defense counsel, I agree too. The court, okay, so I don't want to prevent the defense in any way from arguing that the defendant was afraid for his life and that's the whole reason why he grabbed the gun and fired it. But again, I think the defense from that point is that I fired the gun into the air to scare them off, which doesn't really fit with a true self-defense claim. But again, defense counsel will give you the full latitude to argue essentially what the defendant's testimony was. Defense counsel, I believe that's accurate. You described it. Well, bad facts make for bad law, folks. I mean, if the court's saying, I'm fine with you arguing that he shot at the victim because he was in fear for his life, how would that not be self-defense? He fired the warning shot because he was in fear for his life. How would that not be self-defense? All right, back to the dissent here in Ohio v. Wilson. In light of the trial court's explanation, defense counsel's not requesting a jury instruction on self-defense was reasonable. Well, I would disagree. That's not a rational argument by the dissent. Just because the trial court provides an explanation doesn't mean that defense counsel agreeing with that explanation is reasonable. It could be an unreasonable agreement. Continuing now with this dissent, the lead opinion also discounts defense counsel's closing argument. While the lead opinion mentions in a footnote that during closing argument, defense counsel questioned whether Wilson was the shooter, the lead opinion ignores the core of defense counsel's argument, which was that Wilson was not shooting at Ruffett, but was instead firing a warning shot. Now quoting from, the closing argument at trial by the defense. defense counsel. Reference in an elevated position over my client brandishing a weapon. My client's driving a car that he knows doesn't start all the time. How would anybody here feel in that position? Vulnerable? Scared? He testified he didn't shoot at him. A bunch of you here are into guns, like I am, speaking to the jury. And anybody who has ever shot a gun knows that a 9mm, the opinion, the dissent, well, the transcript writes 0.9 millimeter, which would be a pretty small bullet, folks. That would be a dart. Anyway, knows that a 9mm bullet will go through sheet metal. He didn't intend to shoot Reffitt. It wouldn't have gone straight up. Close quote. Defense counsel's closing argument makes clear that he did not abandon the self-defense theory. He simply understood that Wilson's version of events did not constitute a true affirmative defense. He took pains to explain the distinction to the jury. Now quoting the defense closing again. Quote, there is no proof to show that Wilson committed the crimes that he's charged with. He didn't really act in self-defense. Self-defense would be if he tried to shoot somebody. That's true self-defense. There is a bearing there of self-defense, but he was acting more of himself than others when he shot in the air. Whatever that means. He wasn't shooting at the person, so that's not true self-defense. There is an element there, but that's not why you need it. That's what you need to think about. He did not intend to murder, did not intend to hit. He fired to ward off and scare and get out of that situation. And that's why he took off and was pursued by a man with a gun that was waving it out the window. So when you go back there and deliberate, jury, I just want to point out the state has not met its burden. He did not attempt to hurt or murder anybody. He shot in the air in defense of himself and his passenger. Close quote. Back to the dissent. Reviewed with the appropriate deference, defense counsel's performance did not fall below an objective standard of reasonable representation. Conclusion of the dissent. Wilson attempted to negate an element of felonious assault by claiming at trial that he did not intend to shoot at Reffitt. The evidence presented at trial did not constitute a true affirmative defense. Therefore, a self-defense jury instruction was not warranted. And in any event, trial counsel was not ineffective. Because the lead opinion sees it differently, I respectfully dissent, along with two other of the 7 Ohio Supreme Court justices. So everybody's making this case a lot more complicated than it seems to be, frankly. For one thing, you're allowed as the defense to argue inconsistent defenses. You can argue, I'll go back up to the top so we'll see what this is. You're allowed to argue, one, I'm arguing that I didn't intend to cause harm or attempt to cause harm, so I'm not guilty of felonious assault on an element-negating basis. But if you don't believe that, if you believe I did intend, well, then that intentional act was lawful self-defense. That's permissible, and perhaps that's what defense counsel should have done here. What they shouldn't certainly have done is, especially when you hear him in his closing, the part that's included here from the transcript of the defense closing argument, he's speaking the language of self-defense, but he just waved away the self-defense jury instruction, didn't even object when the judge said he didn't want to give it. I expect if defense counsel had demanded that the self-defense and jury instruction be given, that the judge would have conceded. The reason the judge didn't give it was he felt it probably wasn't appropriate. The state certainly, of course, was happy to take self-defense off the table as a legal defense. And then the defendant agreed. Defense counsel agreed. So, of course, everyone, all the legal professionals in the trial are saying, oh, yeah, and it's not self-defense. We shouldn't even talk about it to the jury. Of course it's coming off. But if defense counsel had objected, almost certainly the jury would have gotten the jury instruction. Now, of course, Wilson's conviction here on felonious assault is reversed. It's remanded back to the trial. The prosecution is free to retry Wilson, not on the attempted murder charge, because Wilson was acquitted on that. So that's gone. That's off the table. Double jeopardy prohibits being retried on a charge on which you've been acquitted. But they can retry him on the felonious assault charge. The only thing now is the trial court's informed that they are obliged to give a jury instruction on self-defense. Of course, the state has now also been educated by this dissent on how they can best argue their position in the context of a self-defense jury instruction. All right. That is all I have for Ohio v. Wilson, except for the law of self-defense member chat and questions. I'll take a look at those now. Law of self-defense members get all their comments and questions addressed for free, sometimes even their emails. I have an email comment. And it's dirt cheap to be a law of self-defense member. It's only 99 cents for a two-week trial membership. Get all your questions and comments addressed for free. Get the transcripts of our shows. Get all our members-only content. 99 cents, folks, to try it out for 2 weeks at lawofselfdefense.com/trial. And after the 2 weeks, if you stay a member, and virtually everybody does, it's still dirt cheap. It's only 30 cents a day, roughly less than $10 a month to be a law of self-defense member. Again, at lawofselfdefense.com/trial. Or if you insist and you're watching this on YouTube, you can ask questions and comments on YouTube, and I will address them if they're a $10 or minimum super chat. I don't know why anybody would do that. For less than 10 bucks a month, you get everything answered for a month instead of $10 a question. But what can I say? Some people are more comfortable taking that approach. But it looks like not today. So, just the law of self-defense member questions and comments. Let me pull them over in front of my camera so they're easier for me to see. All right, law of self-defense members. Yep, everyone's catching up on daylight savings now, second day in. Yesterday morning was kind of tough. I usually wake up an hour before my alarm goes off, but that didn't happen yesterday. Yesterday, my alarm woke me up. Let's see. Bup, bup, bup. Donna writes, and all this time, Tyler Wilson was convicted and sitting in prison with a total sentence of 18 to 20 years. He's probably very happy to get a second bite at the apple, a new trial. Yeah, I mean, this is clearly... it's clearly a win. You can't describe it as anything else. Let's see if I can refresh my recollection on the date that this happened. I don't think he was in jail for too long. Let's see. June 8th, 2021. And this is 2024. So about 2.75 years sitting in prison, not jail. He'd be sitting in prison having been convicted at trial. So it's certainly not nothing. And imagine if he gets a retrial, and he probably stays in prison, by the way, for his retrial. Imagine being on retrial and you get acquitted. And when's retrial? Let's say it happens by the end of this year. So then he would have been sitting in prison for 3.5 years until he was acquitted on retrial, if we presume an acquittal. Yep, that's how the system works. Let's see. 0.9 millimeter. Crazy. Yeah, most people don't know guns, folks. Philip asks, does a dissent like this provide a roadmap of argument to make in future cases? Yeah, I mentioned a moment ago, the dissent provided the prosecution for basically a roadmap to how they should argue if they retry Wilson again in the context of self-defense. Yeah, 0.9 millimeter, the reverse from Hannah Gutierrez. They had trial testimony about a nine meter round, which would be pretty big. 27 foot wide round. Let's see. Oscar, law of self-defense member Oscar asks, question, when, pre-trial or during trial, does my attorney present evidence to meet the burden of production for a claim of self-defense? Well, you want to do it pre-trial. Normally, most jurisdictions, the defense has to notify the state prosecution that the defense intends to argue self-defense. You have to give notice so that the states has an opportunity to prepare, because the burden's on them to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt if you raise it. So they're entitled to be put on notice that they're going to have that burden. You intend to argue self-defense, they can prepare experts and witnesses and whatever. So they're ready to argue against self-defense, to attempt to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. If you don't give that notice in a timely fashion, whatever time frame that jurisdiction demands, you can be denied the privilege to argue self-defense on that basis. And that obviously would be ineffective assistance of counsel if your lawyer screwed that up. That's just a paperwork scheduling thing. But if you have the evidence to support your burden of production, you want to do it pretrial with your notification to the state that you intend to argue self-defense, so that it's settled pretrial that self-defense will be permitted as a legal defense in the trial, and you don't have to worry about that. Sometimes, in marginal cases of self-defense, the defendant won't be able to meet their burden of production pretrial, and they'll be asking the judge, listen, Your Honor, let me argue self-defense anyway during the course of the trial, because evidence will develop. Witnesses take the stand. I'll subject the state's witnesses to cross-examination. I'll be bringing my own witnesses, and I'll be eliciting during the trial the evidence that will meet my burden of production. And then once I've done that, you can give the jury the self-defense jury instruction at the end. And if I fail to do that in the court's opinion, if I still have not met my burden of production by the end, well, then you're free to deny the self-defense jury instruction. That tends to happen more in bad guy cases of self-defense. In good guy cases of self-defense, it's generally not hard to meet the burden of production pretrial. So that's what you should expect to have happen. It shouldn't be... I really never see good guy cases of self-defense where the burden of production can't be met. And then it's met pretrial. Let's see. Jeffrey says, while I am open to the giving of the self-defense jury instruction by a warning shot, it still seems to fail on the, well, he says immense here, but I'm sure he means eminent element. Element's one of the required elements of self-defense, and essentially, it requires that the threat you're defending yourself against be either actually occurring or immediately about to occur. And so a lot of people will argue that, well, if you really believe that you're facing an imminent, immediately about to occur threat of death, you wouldn't be firing a warning shot. You'd be shooting that aggressor. But, you know, how broad that window of imminence opens is a fact question for the jury. It may be that the bad guy's swinging the rifle of his shotgun around towards you, and it's not quite on you yet, and you're hoping you don't have to kill him. You're hoping you can deter him with a warning shot. But if that doesn't work, you're going to have to shoot him right after the warning shot. That's for a jury to decide. Now, if someone is, it's not hard to imagine circumstances in which someone's not even close to facing an imminent deadly force threat. Maybe they're not facing a deadly force threat at all. Maybe there's like a simple trespasser standing in their driveway and they fire a warning shot. Well, then the warning shot would be well outside any context of an imminent deadly force threat for sure. But I think it's not hard for me to imagine fact scenarios in which a warning shot could arguably still be within the context of an imminent threat. Cliff in Colorado Springs says, the original charge doesn't pass a smell test. He never intended to harm the other guy. Well, why wasn't he charged with reckless behavior of carelessly firing into the air? Well, because the state doesn't believe him when he says he never intended to harm him. The state thinks it was a miss. There was a dent in the other fellow's vehicle. The state's position is, no, he attempted to cause that guy harm. He just missed. That's all. And that would qualify as felonious assault. Why not charge with reckless endangerment for the firing of the warning shot? I don't know if that would be an automatically lesser included charge of felonious assault. And sometimes the prosecution just doesn't want to muddy the waters. They want to go in with one clean theory of guilt to sell to the jury, not a bunch of alternative theories. And if you don't buy this criminal charge, we have another criminal charge to sell you. Even the state can't agree, the defense will say. Even the state can't agree on what they think was the crime here. That's reasonable doubt. Let's see. Yeah, right. Autocorrect. Donna says, does this decision trigger a... where'd you go, Donna? Does this decision trigger a malpractice case against trial counsel? Yeah, for sure. Yep, I would be going after that trial counsel's malpractice insurance certainly for the cost of for the cost of the legal defense. That's probably what you're going to get. I mean, I've never been sued for malpractice. I've never been found to be ineffective, so I don't have personal experience with what they go after on this kind of thing. But that's why you carry malpractice insurance as a practicing go to court attorney for sure. Big O asks, isn't it hard to produce evidence that your warning shot wasn't reckless? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, of course it becomes a fact question. I mean, certainly a shot into the air in, you know, any place that's not really rural or on the open ocean, that bullet's coming down someplace where people probably live. I mean, if you're in 1,000 acres of 10,000 acres of national forest, if you're in the wilds of Montana, I guess you could argue it wasn't reckless. It's not foreseeable the bullet could harm someone. There's nobody there. But if you're in a normal populated place where people live, yeah, a shot in the air is almost always going to be easily characterized as reckless. Frankly, even a shot into the ground. I mean, if you're shooting down and that's asphalt or cement, maybe that bullet stops right there, but it doesn't seem likely to me. Even into dirt, you know, you never know where bullets are going to end up once they hit some other object. Water, they skip off water. It would be hard to argue it's not reckless. I guess if you fire directly into something, that would be likely to stop a bullet. Like there's a big oak tree right there and you shoot into the oak tree, that'll probably suck up the bullet. I guess you could argue that's not reckless because you're shooting into what constitutes an effective backstop. That could work. But just shooting into the air, I don't know, how would you defend that as not being reckless? All right, let's see. All right, I think that's everything. So with that, I will wrap up today's show. So for those Law Self-Defense members, the next couple of weeks, there are going to be fewer live streams and more pre-recorded content because I'm working on a consult for a Platinum member, and that takes up a lot of time. And I also have some travel coming up, which keeps me away from my desk and therefore not live streaming. So just be aware of that. So when you go to the, you'll start seeing when you go to, if you're a Law Self-Defense member, you go to our member live stream in the member chat, I'll state there whether that day's content is live or pre-recorded. So just make sure you read, look for that, because sometimes when I put up pre-recorded stuff, people don't notice and they're just waiting for the live stream to start. If it's a pre-recorded content day, there will be no live stream. It'll be in the Law of Self-Defense blog is where you'll find that day's content. All right, folks. So with that, I will remind everybody, if you carry a gun so you're hard to kill, that's why I carry a gun, so I'm hard to kill, so my family is hard to kill, then you also owe it to your family and yourself to make sure you know the law so you're hard to convict as well. Oh, those of you leaving on YouTube, if you're signing out and you're on a mobile, now's your time. Now's your time. Now's your moment to become a subscriber on Law Self-Defense. I am 9 people away from 61,000, or at least I was when the show started. Let's see if anything's changed. Let me refresh that screen. Did we pick up 9 before the end of the show? It looks like we have not. Come on, folks. I need 9 more. I know if you're watching on mobile, you can't click thumbs up or subscribe until you check out. So as you're checking out, please subscribe. Hit that subscribe button. It's 100% free. I really appreciate it. Until next time, I remain Attorney Andrew Branca for the Law of Self-Defense. Stay safe.